From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscoane. He helped the Washington Post win a Pulitzer Prize with his coverage of the Virginia Tech massacre. He has profiled Al Gore for Rolling Stone and Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker, and he covered the 2008 presidential campaign as well. Jose Antonio Vargas has had a storied career as a journalist and has also found himself at the center of one of the biggest controversies in America, the debate over immigration. Vargas shocked the nation when he came out, so to speak, as an undocumented immigrant in a piece he wrote for the New York Times Magazine last year. Since then, he has been working to change the conversation about immigration through speaking engagements and an online project called Define American. Jose joins us today to talk about life before and after his confession and how he's seeking to answer the question, who is an American? Jose, welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've been here since you were 12 years old, and tell us a little bit about, for those who have not read your essay that was in the New York Times, a little bit about how you got here and what your life was like before you finally said, I've had enough of this, I've got to tell my story.
So I was born in the Philippines, and when I was 12, my mom said she wanted to give me a better life, so she sent me to live with her parents, my grandparents, in Mountain View, California, where Google is. So this was in 1993. And, you know, my grandparents are both naturalized American citizens, so I didn't think anything of it, frankly. And this was 1993. I didn't speak too much English, but it was, you know, I remember it was the O.J. Simpson, trial. And Seinfeld. Those were kind of my two biggest introductions to American culture. And then when I was 4 years later, when I was a freshman in high school, like any 16-year-old, I would go to the DMV. And I didn't tell my grandparents. I just went. And I showed the woman, you know, the clerk, my green card. And she looked at it. She kind of flipped it around. And she, I remember her leaning down and saying, this is fake. Don't come back here. I mean, my first instinct was, you know, this woman is lying. And then I remember riding my bike about two blocks from the DMV thinking, wait up a second, like maybe she thought I was Mexican. Because, you know, my name's Jose Antonio Vargas, but I'm Filipino. You know, back then, I mean, I was a victim of my own ignorance. I thought everybody who was quote unquote illegal were Mexican. So I was going to go back and correct her. I'm just going to go home and ask my grandfather about it. And then what got home, I remember my grandpa was sitting, he was cutting coupons in the garage, and confronted him about it. And I remember just kind of the first thing he said was, what are you doing showing that to people? The second thing is, you're not supposed to be here. So that was like, I was 16, I was a freshman, and it was just, you know, I didn't really understand why wouldn't they tell me that?
Right, what's going through your 16-year-old mind when you suddenly hear this?
I was just very, you know, and I was young. I was young and immature, and I was so mad at them. I think I spent all of my high school years just being very mad at them. And, you know, these are kind, hardworking. My grandfather was a security guard. My grandmother was a food server. My mom, I think after that, I blamed her. I was just so mad.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough that a year after that, my English teacher, Mrs. Dewar, said I asked too many annoying questions and I should do this thing called journalism.
Yeah, that's usually a sign.
So she sent me to this thing called a journalism camp at San Francisco State University. And I went, and I just went for 2 weeks. And I guess superficially, when I saw my name on a piece of paper getting published, you know, this thing called a byline, right? I'm like, wait up a second. Like, my name is in the paper. Like, I'm interviewing Americans and I'm writing in English. Like,
I must be legit, right?
And I thought that was existing, you know? Like, and I actually remember thinking to myself, maybe if I just did this enough, you know, mm-hmm. like if I can't be American because I don't have the paper and I'm not born here, maybe I can just write my way to it.
Well, and your story throughout has that theme that if I just work hard enough, if I just do enough, if I'm just good enough, right?
Well, I mean, I actually remember my junior year in high school. You know, everybody, of course, by junior year, it's like everybody's thinking about college, mm-hmm. right? College was never, I never thought about it. It just, because, you know, like, we didn't have Google back then. It was still like Alta Vista. And I remember researching, like, how do I, because I knew that I couldn't apply for financial aid because there was no papers. That wasn't an option. I remember sitting at the library, and the library was like one of my homes. I loved the library because, mm-hmm. you know, I could read everything. I could borrow the movies to learn how to speak better English. Because one of the first things, there's two things that I thought about when I found out that I was, quote unquote, illegal. One is I got to get rid of this accent.
Yeah.
I got to get rid of this thick Filipino accent that I had, you know.
Well, let me stop you there, Jose, because I had to smile when I read about you watching The Golden Girls and Frasier to work on your enunciation.
Not just that, but also I remember Anne of Green Gables. Do you know Anne of Green Gables?
I do.
Oh, man. There was one year my classmates were teasing me because I guess I had this patrician accent or something.
Maybe you went too far the other direction.
It was Marilla Cuthbert from Anne of Green Gables, and I was convinced that I didn't even know what Canada was. I thought it was like in Britain somewhere. So I actually, one of my goals in my life is to visit Prince Edward Island because that's where they filmed it, right?
Right.
But no, when I was in high school at the library, I remember literally making a list of everything I thought I needed to do to be quote unquote successful. Mm-hmm. I was like, I need to work for a big paper. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this thing called the New York Times or like the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the Philadelphia Inquirer, or like, you mm-hmm. know, one of those big regional papers. I needed to win some sort of a prize. I remember thinking I need to be a political reporter because people think that's like sexy.
Right.
And then I remember thinking there's this thing called the New Yorker that I picked up at one point. And I couldn't understand it because all the words were like $10 words. And, you know, this was pre-Merriam-Webster.com Wikipedia. Yeah. And you actually had to go to the
encyclopedia. You have to have a dictionary with you, right?
I remember thinking to myself, man, like if I ever get published there, maybe I'll be like a quote unquote, like serious writer. Mm-hmm. Then by the time I was like, you know, like about in the middle of 2010, I was 29. I was about to be 30. Everything on the list that mm-hmm. I had written down, I had done.
Yeah.
Everything on the list. I never thought I would actually get them done, but I did.
Yeah.
And
but all the while, Jose, you're holding this secret, you know, and you're becoming more and more successful, but this thing's nagging at you, right?
I can't believe that I actually made it as far as I did. You know, it was almost like being visible, but wanting to be invisible at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember being here, you know. Philadelphia was the first East Coast city I actually visited. This was in pre-9/11. This mm-hmm. was 2000. I was here from June to August 2001. I lived at Penn at a frat house, a crazy frat house at Penn. And I remember walking around, you know, just around here, actually, with the Constitutional Hall and the Bell and thinking, this can't last. Like someone was gonna catch me.
Yeah. And you know, we all have that imposter fear at some level that it's just a matter of time before they figure me out, that I really don't know what I'm doing. But for you, the stakes were a whole lot higher.
Well, I mean, I walked around as if I had like illegal tattooed in my forehead. And mind you, you know, I don't look, my name is Jose Antonio Vargas and I look like I'm like the younger brother of Yao Ming. You know, I look very Asian. And so I can only imagine what young undocumented people who are brown mm-hmm. must feel.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I was one of the lucky ones that I was always able to pass. Mm-hmm. I was the one who was, I was the one that acted too paranoid about it.
Well, and you had a network of people around you
exactly.
who were really instrumental in you being able to succeed.
And thank
right?
you for bringing that up. I mean, and really that's what Define American is really about, is to in some ways take immigration out of the ghetto in our heads, thinking that it's only a Latino issue or only an Asian issue, and really try to elevate the conversation and have a much fuller conversation around it. Meaning, if it wasn't for my high school teachers and my high school principal and my high school superintendent and the senior editor of the Washington Post, you know, who each time I thought I couldn't do this anymore, they were the ones that kind of, I don't know, I guess they've always seen, you know, America, or like, they've always considered me American. So they were the ones that really enabled my success. Actually, this is interesting. So this Saturday, San Francisco State, where I graduated from college, decided to name me Alumnus of the Year.
Wow.
And a little crazy.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. But it was very nice. You know, it's only been 8 years since I got out of college, so it was very nice of them to do that. But I'm bringing, you know, the guy that sent me, the venture capitalist that sent me to college, my principal and my superintendent. It's really theirs, you know? Like, they were the ones that
that
said,
always
you gotta
helped
go
you
to college.
Yeah, they helped you to figure out that next step every time you hit a roadblock,
but
right?
But if every undocumented person like me has five or six people in their lives, American citizens in their lives, who are helping them out, who are answering to, in some ways, a higher moral calling, then this is an issue that impacts way more than 12 million people.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's the estimated number, right?
Yeah, about 12 million undocumented people. But if each of us has 4 to 5 people, then this is an issue that impacts a lot of people.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel as if that reality of how integrated this issue is in American society, right? It's in our churches, it's in our schools, it's in our communities. It's not just waiting for a job outside of a Home Depot. It's not just mowing your lawn, right? I think it's really important that we have much fuller integrated understanding of it.
Yeah.
And and I don't want to get too much into politics of this, but it's hard to not do that, but which is why when Mitt Romney says a solution is self-deportation, it's completely divorced from reality. It's a talking point. It's politics as theater.
Yeah.
And it doesn't recognize the complexity and the gray area that people live in. Nothing about this issue is black or white. Yeah.
Speaking of politics, when we come back from our break, I want to talk to you about the DREAM Act. I know that that was an inspiration for you, and the young people who, you know, sort of led the way with that were an inspiration for you as well. Marco Rubio has his version of the DREAM Act. I'm sure you're aware of that, so
yes,
we'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that. And just also, you know, what it was like for you, what the fallout has been from this confession, and what life has been like for you in the months since you came out and wrote that essay for the New York Times Magazine. We're talking with Jose Antonio Vargas. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions for him. The number is 888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964. They are currently performing research to develop improved treatments for people who experience periods of depression followed by uncontrollable shifts between highly energized and depressive moods. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
The Philadelphia Inquirer proudly supports WHYY. The Inquirer recently won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism for its Assault on Learning multimedia investigative series. News and more. The Inquirer. Your life. Your stories.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowane. We have been talking with Jose Antonio Vargas, and if that name rings a bell, it may be because you read his essay last summer in the New York Times Magazine, where he just told the truth about being an undocumented immigrant. Jose has had a storied career as a journalist. He has worked for the Washington Post and a number of other publications. He has profiled people like Mark Zuckerberg and others. And so he's had quite a career as a journalist, and then found himself at the center of perhaps his biggest story ever last year when he wrote this essay. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions for Jose, or perhaps you have had an experience where, you know, your life has been touched by someone who is an undocumented immigrant. You've got experience in that regard. We'd love to hear your story as well. The number is 888-477-9499. And Jose, I'm just thinking, in the time, the years leading up to your confession in that essay, what was the effect on you? I mean, we talked a little bit about how difficult it was to keep that secret and that sense that I'm going to be found out. What did that do to you? When I think about, you know, mentally, emotionally, even physically, sometimes those kinds of things can literally make a person sick. What were the effects on you in sort of trying to hold all of that together before you finally wrote the essay?
I've been very lucky that I think, considering everything that happened and that I was kind of living with, that I tried to be as productive as I could, and I tried to be as centered and grounded as I possibly could. And again, I have a tremendous support network of people, you mm-hmm. know, like people that I've known since middle school.
Yeah.
But it was really tough, and I can only imagine what young people now mm-hmm. are going through. Because yeah. remember, now that they're living in this age of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, right? And to me, the power of these tools is it asks people to tell their own stories,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and everybody is living their life
very publicly.
Yeah.
And, I know, I mean, here in Pennsylvania alone, you know, there's a Dream Activist Pennsylvania, which is a group of dreamers, undocumented youth, that are active in the state. Just a few months ago, I think there were a couple of college students, one from Penn and one from Bryn Mawr, who got arrested. You know, they did a kind of a civil disobedience at an ICE office, at an immigration office here.
Wow.
And you can't, I mean, let's put this into context. These are young people who have grown up studying the civil rights movement. And these are young people who grew up in the time of kind of Ellen DeGeneres and, you know, the coming out
yeah.
generation,
yeah.
right? And so I think more and more young people will keep coming out.
Mm-hmm.
More of us will insist to be seen fully,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I like what you said about all I did was tell the truth.
Yeah,
That's all I did. And as far as I'm concerned, there's a whole lot of truth telling that we haven't done about the contributions that people like me mm-hmm. make in this country. The taxes that we pay, the jobs that we have. And again, you know, look, I understand, like, we are in the middle of an economic depression. People still are, you know, everyone's having a hard time. But, and I think in some ways, in really sad ways, tragic ways, you know, undocumented people have been the one to blame. Which is really staggering, you know. I've spent the past year now traveling around the country. I've been to maybe 20 states. I was in Alabama, and Alabama tried to out Arizona. What I mean by mm-hmm. that is that Alabama has the toughest immigration law in the country. Tougher than Arizona's.
Wow.
Actually, for a while there, teachers had to ask for the immigration status of their students. Can you imagine?
Well, and I want to ask you about those things, yeah. Jose, because we do want to talk about politics. I do have one question before we get to that, and that's this, that have you taken heat from people? You've made this confession, and here you are. You're a journalist. You're in a business that's all about telling the truth.
Absolutely.
Right? So how would you respond to someone who says, well, wait a minute, you're in the truth-telling business, and you've been covering up your real identity all this time? What would you say to someone who would raise that concern?
Well, I mean, I'm also openly gay, and I wonder what concerns people had about gay people not disclosing their, sexuality, back in the 50s or 40s or 20s, right? And so there's that too. But I mean, from the very beginning, I said, I stand by my work. Look at the work. The work will speak for itself. Mm-hmm. As for my personal life, to me, the question is, why did I lie? Look, I remember getting that Philadelphia Daily News internship, and I loved working at the Philadelphia Daily News. Oh my God, that was such an amazing experience. Thinking to myself, man, did I take this internship spot from someone else? I remember Debbie Licklider, she was the recruiter there. She's still the recruiter, I think. Mm-hmm. She's like, hey, so you got one of the internships. I remember, calling my principal, who's like my mom, right? Hey, did I take somebody else's spot?
Mm.
And she was like, don't, she laughed and, don't be silly. Like, you earned this, right? I'm sorry, and I've apologized, and I will keep apologizing for not disclosing this truth about myself. But at the same time, I wanted to work.
Yeah.
I wanted to live. I wanted to survive. And for me, the biggest question I'm trying to answer is why? Why did I have to lie, and why do people like me have to lie? Mm. And here's the bigger question. Why are we here? Why are people here, right? Like, what are the economic realities? What are the political realities, right? Like, what does U.S. foreign policy, what do U.S. trade agreements have to do with people moving around, right? Those are the tough questions. And we haven't even gotten there because we're still stuck at the same first paragraph.
Let me invite our listeners to join in our conversation. Perhaps your life has been touched in some way by an undocumented immigrant. You've got experience one way or the other in that regard, and we'd be very interested to hear from you at 888-477-9499. Jose, certainly there have been real instances, though, where, you have people who complain about, there are illegal immigrants who don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. You did, but there are those who do not. There are those, people who say, who at least perceive illegal immigrants to be a drain on the social services in the country. How do you respond to those complaints?
Well, I'm a journalist, and so the first thing I do is I research, I look around, and, I'm not sure if people realize here in Pennsylvania alone, undocumented people paid $135 million in state and local taxes in 2010, $35 million of that in state income taxes, and $7 million in property taxes, which means what? People actually own places, right? But to me, it's also a question of people aren't just taking resources, we're also putting resources in. We all pay the same sales tax. And look, the IRS doesn't care whether or not I have papers. The IRS cares whether or not I pay my taxes.
Are you paying your bill by the 15th?
Yes. And there's one thing that I've been actually trying to research very hard is I wonder how many undocumented people have been paying into Social Security that, of course, we can't get back. I alone paid a lot into it. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not going to get that back, and I understand that. But these are the facts that people just don't know.
Yeah.
As for the crowding of the schools, look, I was, as I said, in Alabama. What was so interesting about being in Alabama was after interviewing mostly white conservative Alabamians, you would think J-Lo had encamped in the middle of town. You would think all of these Mexicans just moved into the center of town. Alabama is 4% Hispanic. Hmm. 4%.
Yeah, so
I think it's way bigger. Look, it is really hard to separate race from this conversation.
Yeah.
And that's a tough one. I'm very sensitive to that. I understand that people feel like the country is changing and the way that it looks is changing. But sometimes we end up using terms like they're coming here, they're taking my, you know, I remember one woman actually, I did kind of a Jay Leno man on the street outside of a Kohl's department store. And she started going like, well, they're just taking jobs away. I'm like, well, ma'am, which jobs? Well, you know, so I ended up, you know, like the governor of Alabama said that they had to get rid of these migrant workers, right? Because Alabamians wanted to go to work. Well, guess what? After the migrant farmers got up and left and what, Alabama lost millions of dollars in crops not being picked, they opened it up to everybody. Mm-hmm. 30 people showed up to pick. And what did they say? The job was too hard.
Yeah, I think there have been a lot of cases of undocumented immigrants taking those jobs that perhaps Americans are not interested in doing at this point.
Exactly.
Jose, what do you say? You know, you brought up Arizona, and that law certainly is now being considered by the Supreme Court, and it'll be interesting to see where they take that.
It doesn't look good, at least from the – I mean, I was there on the oral hearing. I mean, I was there at this, you know, in D.C. during the first day of the oral hearing, and it looks like the most controversial provision is going to stay intact, which is that a police officer can stop anybody whom they deem to think is, quote-unquote, illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does illegal look like? That's kind of my question. What does that look like?
Yeah.
And to me, you can't separate what's happening right now, right, from the demographic reality that we're living in. The fact that this country is looking different.
Yeah. What do you say, Jose, to those in Arizona in particular who would say, you have to look at the problems that we've had at the border. You know, we've had these murders, we've had crime, we've had all kinds of problems with people coming in illegally, and we are the ones who are really feeling the brunt of that. What do you say to someone who makes a legitimate complaint
issue? And that is a legitimate complaint. That is a legitimate concern. The problem is, you've equated these people who are moving here to criminals, right? The way you listen to the rhetoric, you would think everybody's a murderer, right? Undocumented people are just like everybody else. We're no more heroic, we're no dumber, we're no smarter. We're just people, right? And I think the mistake has been to think that everybody's committing all these crimes and they're raping people and it sounds like a horror story, when that's just not simply the truth. Now, I do believe that that we need to figure out what to do with the border, although that also requires some truth-telling. The number of illegal border crossings in the country right now are at its lowest level since Nixon was president, right? And so when you hear politicians say, we need to secure the border, we need to secure the border, the facts are saying, we've done that. Now what are we going to do?
Well, let's go to the phones because we've got some people who would love to talk to you. We'll start off in Runnymede, New Jersey, and we'll welcome James to Radio Times. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, I know that it was touched on a little bit earlier in the show, but according to the screener, but I had missed the beginning of the show. But I was just wondering, with all the requirements that and the things that it takes to be gainfully employed and attend university and do different things like that, I was just wondering how it came to be that you were able to go so far in your academic and professional life, you know, without a lot of the paperwork, I guess, and the things that are the prerequisites that a lot of folks have to even, you know, go to school or have a job. I was just wondering how that worked, you know, to go from being concerned about being found out, you know, to profiling Mark Zuckerberg is a quantum leap, and I'm just wondering how that came about.
Thanks for the question. That's a really good question. So I went to San Francisco State University, which is a state school, and at that time, there was no requirements about showing any sort of paper. All I needed to do was show like a mailing address about where I lived. And since I wasn't applying for financial aid because I couldn't, you know, this venture capitalist paid for all of college. So there was no requirement for that. For the jobs, I mean, I remember like it was just yesterday filling out the form at a job at the San Francisco Chronicle right after high school. That was like my first job. And I remember looking at the form and, you know, you have that section where you have to check whether you're a resident alien or you're a U.S. citizen, right? I couldn't check the resident alien because if I check it, they would ask for a number that I don't have. So I actually thought to myself, okay, I'm not a U.S. citizen, but if I don't check this box, I don't get this job. So why don't I check this box? And why don't I live up to what that means? So that's how I, as kind of crazy as that sounds, that's how I justified that in my head, right? As for the Social Security number, my grandfather, I think I was already 16 or 17 at this point, because I didn't know what a Social Security number was. All I knew is I had it. I then realized that my grandfather got the Social Security number from a fake passport that I'd been using all of this time, right? And I actually thought to myself, okay, they're going to find this out. Like, they're gonna find this out. And then I would get letters saying, thank you for your payment into Social Security. I'm like, oh, what? So, okay, so I am paying this. Because, you know, like when you get a paycheck, it says minus Social Security, right?
Right.
So that was interesting. And I thought I remember giving that Social Security number to the Secret Service when I had to cover a White House state dinner. This was when President Bush was president, 2005, the state dinner for the Japanese prime minister. And it sounds comical now, but I literally remember sitting in my office, you know, sitting in my desk at the Washington Post, waiting for a phone call.
Wow. Sweating bullets.
I was like, somebody is going to look at that number. They're going to run it through whatever they need to run it through. And they're going to find out that I'm not supposed to have it. And they're going to come here. I need to explain to my editor. How do I tell Don Graham? How do I?
Yeah. Well, and Jose, it sounds like a lot of your success, I mean, I won't say a lot of your success, but a portion of your success, beyond having, you know, the smarts and the intelligence and the drive, then you had the network of people who were willing to help you, but also you benefited from the fact that in a lot of these cases, people weren't doing all their homework in terms of checking the paperwork.
Well, I mean, again, I only imagine that requires a whole heck of a lot of reporting, which is why, I mean, if we really care about national security, if we really care about knowing who are here, can you imagine if we actually said, all right, we know you're here. Please come forward. We want to know who's here. Mm-hmm. We haven't even done that.
Yeah.
How many other people? I'm convinced that there's countless other people out there who are just trying to get by, right? And living in the nightmare of this whole thing.
Jose, in our last minute or so before we take another break, speaking of making a living, how are you able to support yourself now? I mean, after you have come clean with this confession, a lot of people who probably would love to hire you would be hesitant to do that.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
That was really tough. I mean, the irony of this is the first time in my whole life that I've been unemployed. I mean, because I can't be hired. And so thankfully I have, a group of lawyers who've been advising me. And it's funny because now, it's not funny. Now I'm really, you know, I am living as an undocumented immigrant, so I need to know what are the venues for me to work, right? And all I can be is an independent contractor. Mm-hmm. That's all I can be is an independent contractor. And, you know, I've written for like Entertainment Weekly, and I've done something for New York Times book review, and they can all just pay me as an independent contractor.
Yeah. So you have to be a freelancer.
I have to be a freelancer, basically. Yeah. So that's how I've been making a living.
Well, we've got much more to talk about and a number of calls for you as well. We are talking with Jose Antonio Vargas. He is an undocumented immigrant. He is a storied, rewarded journalist. And much more to his story and your questions when Radio Times comes right back.
Quintessence Theater Group proudly supports WHYY and presents Anton Chekhov's The Seagull. Passion, poetry, and heartbreak abound on the shores of a magical lake in Anton Chekhov's romantic tragic comedy, The Seagull, starring Janice Dardaris. Now at the Sedgwick Theater in Mount Airy through June 3rd. Tickets, information, and performance schedules at 877-238-5596 or quintessencetheater.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A woman who snatched her children from their father and became the first American ever to gain asylum in the Netherlands because of her claims they were unsafe is back in the U.S. We'll hear her story. Also, the Tom Rush Ode to Graduation. Get a hanky. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Cooper Heart Valve Center supports WHYY. Aortic valve stenosis affects nearly 300,000 people annually. Cooper is the first hospital in South Jersey offering a new non-surgical valve repair, the Sapien Heart Valve. This FDA-approved technology offers a treatment option for patients unable to undergo valve surgery and is expected to transform the treatment of aortic valve disease. More at 800-8-COOPER or cooperhealth.org/sapien.
You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. We've been having a discussion with Jose Antonio Vargas. He is the undocumented immigrant who wrote about his story in a New York Times Magazine essay last summer after having a very, very prolific career as a journalist. He worked for the Washington Post. He had some very plum assignments in a number of places and told his story, and people have been talking about it ever since. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got questions, comments for Jose, the number is 888-477-9499. And Jose, we do have people already waiting to talk to you, so we'll start off in Swedesboro and we'll welcome Jerry to Radio Times. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Mr. Vargas. How are you?
Oh, thank you for calling in.
I have a question for you regarding the jeopardy that you put your employers in when you falsified your applications
Yes.
on your I-9 report. How can you justify that?
That's a really, really good question. I justified it by working really hard. I justified it by telling myself, okay, because remember, one of the things I really had to ask myself was, am I taking somebody else's spot? I'm taking somebody else's spot. I'm not supposed to be here. I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to do such a good job that I'm going to be the only person who can do this. I'm going to be so successful. This is how crazy my world was in my head, that I'm going to be the only one that Mark Zuckerberg would even talk to. Right? And for me, the hardest part in all of this, one of the hardest parts was before the essay came out, I had to, you know, confess and apologize. I went directly to the top. I went to Don Graham, you know, who's the owner of the Washington Post Company. I went to Arianna Huffington, who's a delightful, delightful woman. I went to Phil Bronstein, who was my editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I apologized to all three of them. I put them in an incredibly compromising position. And I told them that I'm sorry and that I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to put them in that position, but I felt like I didn't have a choice.
How did they respond, Jose, when you called them and came clean?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I'm really lucky. I was very lucky. I've been very lucky. They responded in incredibly humane ways.
Mm-hmm.
They understood. But at the same time, they also understood that this is, you know, a complicated issue. And that's why when I, quote unquote, came out, I was unemployed. I had to be completely independent.
Yeah.
I had left all of the jobs. I mean, in some ways it made sense because, you know, I left the Washington Post. Don Graham said I should stay. I left Arianna Huffington after being at the Huffington Post for a year. I knew that I couldn't be employed and I couldn't be at a job when I wanted to do this.
Speaking of the Washington Post, your essay originally was meant to be published in the Post. They killed it at the last
minute. They killed it like days before they were supposed to publish it. And thankfully, Peter Baker, who's a friend of mine, who was at the Washington Post, now at the New York Times, he helped me get into the New York Times.
Mm. Why did they kill it last minute?
You know, the editor of the paper, Marcus Brockley, who's a, you know, good journalist, he couldn't really explain.
Were they concerned that now they're culpable because they have employed you?
But they
concerned from, about, yeah. you know, this guy's been hiding his identity all these years. Are we sure now that this story is true?
Yeah.
Was there an element of that?
Of course there's that. But, you know, I remember, you know, I've written maybe 700 or so news stories in my life. And maybe I've had 5 or 6 corrections, all of them kind of name, you know, I misspelled mm-hmm. somebody's name or whatever. I knew that this article had to be tight. There could not be any holes. There couldn't be any inaccuracies, even like, you know, a different name of town or everything had to be tight.
Fact checking had to
be really tight, because if it weren't, everybody was going to start picking holes and figure out if I Jason Blair'd my way into this or something. So the Washington Post fact checked it. You know, I was working with them for this. I was working with Carlos Lozada, who's the editor there, and Ann Gerhardt, for like at least 3 months on the story. And I think we were all kind of shocked that they killed it. But again, you know, I was lucky in some ways it worked out for the better. The New York Times ran it and gave it a really nice kind of, you know, packaging.
Well, we'll go back to the phones to Newark, Delaware, and we'll welcome John to Radio Times. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a, well, not really a quick question, but I would like to learn more about what the guest feels would be effective policies moving forward. Currently, the H-1A, the H-2B, and the H-1B visas only offer 200,000 individuals access into the United States each year. That's roughly a fraction of a percent of the unauthorized immigrants who are already in the state. So there was an amnesty program under Reagan, of all people, offered in 86 and 87.
Yep.
And the unauthorized population has only grown since. So I'll leave that open to the speaker to comment on.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much for that question. I mean, I'm sure, John, you probably know this and have met people in this situation. How many graduates, you know, who went to school in America who are now had to leave America to start their companies and work elsewhere because they couldn't stay here? Mind you, because of my essay, because I admitted to everything, I'm disqualified for any one of the visas that you had just mentioned, even from the EB-1, which is the Extraordinary Ability Visa. So, and I knew that coming in. But I think what's so important is to realize just how we need to rethink just the whole immigration. Not just how broken the system is, but what the process is or the lack of process. And to me, you know, what's been fascinating is to hear, you know, Mitt Romney talk about self-deportation and to hear them. You hear this from a lot of politicians, particularly in the Republican Party, that people like me should get in the back of the line. I would really like to know where the line is. You know, if the line is somewhere in Center City near Rittenhouse Square, I'll take my James Baldwin books and some Beyonce albums and I'll wait for as long as you want me to wait. But there's no line. There's no process. Instead, what we have is an underground economy where people are afraid. We do not know who's here, right? And not only that, we have absolutely no idea, mind you, I think 12 million is a conservative estimate. I think it has to be more than 12 million. And I would rather know what that is, and I would rather us figure out, all right, if you've been here, 63% of undocumented people like me have been here for more than 10 years. 63%, right? So if you want us to pay back taxes, learn how to speak English, pay a fine, and get in the back of the line, I'd be more than happy to do any of that, if that's the case. But that doesn't exist right now. All we have is empty rhetoric and political theater. That's what we have.
Before we go back to the phones, Jose, I want to ask you a couple of things here about Marco Rubio, because we mentioned him a little bit earlier, never got to the question. He's got a version of the DREAM Act. What do you think about it? Does it go far enough? Is he the right person to promote it? What are your thoughts?
Well, I warmly and wholeheartedly welcome Marco Rubio into this conversation. I'm glad that he's a part of it because, you know, he in the past has, again, he's been against the DREAM Act in the past. So I'm glad that he's part of the conversation and I'm sure he's been having some very uncomfortable conversations with his own within his own party. It's hard to comment on the bill that doesn't exist. Nothing has been written. So I'll kind of save judgment for that. What I do know is, I do not know what I can tell. And I mean, the hardest thing for me is talking to like young undocumented people, you know, who are either last week I was just talking on the phone with a Korean undocumented Korean kid who's a registered nurse. I don't know. We need more registered nurses in this country, right? Who is right now working at a sushi restaurant as a waiter because he can't be a registered nurse. By the way, so he gets around town because of a bike that his pastor bought him. Right. I don't know how many more kids, how many more educated young people who could be contributing back to the society that has given them so much, mm-hmm. are we going to let down? But I also know that the DREAM Act is only one part of a much bigger conversation mm-hmm. about this.
Yeah.
It's just one part, and we can't even get that one right. Yeah.
Well, let's go to New York next, and we'll welcome Gerald to Radio Times. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment. I have been married twice to illegal immigrants to help them get their documents. They were both sisters of a friend of mine. I got married for the first time 25 years ago, and I got married again about 10 years ago, and I've helped them and their families get their documents. But I just want to say that most Americans do not have a clue as to how difficult this process is. And the whole marriage route is the fastest and the easiest way, and each time it took more than 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I just think that most Americans are clueless. They think that maybe people just sign up at the embassy in their country, and 6 months later the documents come through.
I mean, this
that's
is
my comment.
I mean, this is not like Sandra Bullock in The Proposal. Like, it doesn't work like that. And you know, I mean, and thank you for actually bringing this up. So I'm gay. I've come out of the closet twice in my life. I'm done. I'm totally done.
Yeah, you've had some big announcements to make over
totally
the last
done.
Several years.
But I can't, even though I live in New York, and New York recognizes same-sex marriage, the federal government does not, because of the Defense of Marriage Act, right, that Bill Clinton signed into law. And as much as Arizona thinks that it can regulate immigration, the federal government regulates immigration and hands out visas. So I can't get a visa through marrying, you know, mm-hmm. a partner because of that. Hmm. So that's kind of the other complication. So I'm really kind of screwed.
Well, on that note, we'll go to Dover, Delaware next, and we'll say hi to Ruth Ann. Welcome, Ruth Ann, to Radio Times.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I love Radio Times.
Oh, good. Well, thanks. We're happy to hear that, and I'm sure Marty will be thrilled.
I'm reflecting on this question, why do people come here in light of the work that I've been doing here? And I'm just curious if Jose could be hired as a consultant to me, what he would suggest or how we could work to move forward. And I imagine, and, you know, being in the communications business, I'm sure Jose can take this with him wherever he goes, but just defining the American dream or the four freedoms, human rights, what are the rights of undocumented workers, what are the differences between the rights and the privileges, and even the differences between the countries people come from, how they define human rights. It's so challenging right now.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Especially with my work, because I'm doing work with returning veterans and post-traumatic stress syndrome, and their families sometimes are undocumented workers. Plus, I have Native American families, and their families are fighting just to be able to put their ethnicity on the 2010 census. The Shinnecock spent 30 years demanding that they be allowed to say who they are on the census.
Ruth Ann, I'm going to stop you right there because we're running out of time, and I want to make sure Jose has a moment to respond to the points that you've brought up.
Well, thank you for the offer of help. I got and maybe you know this. You know, it wasn't until 1924 that we even gave Native American citizenship. Hmm. It wasn't until 1924 that we finally gave the people who were originally here citizenship. Let's ponder that for like. I remember when I first read it, I'm like, oh my God, this can't be true. This can't be real. I mean, as a journalist, okay, I need like a third source and a fourth source to confirm this. And when I did, and that's why the name of the campaign is Define American. You know, let's take criminality and illegality out of this. Let's look at the history of this country. Let's figure out who's coming here, why they came here, right? And you know, you can argue that ever since this country was founded, we've been fighting about whom we define to be Americans. Let's talk to African Americans about that.
And that's why you're encouraging people to submit their stories.
Absolutely.
At Define
and
America.
This is not just about Asian people and Latinos. This is much bigger than that. Yeah. You know, if you're not Native American who was here before anybody got here, if you're not an African American who got here because of slavery, we all came here from somewhere. Yeah.
So, Jose, for people who want to share their story with you, who want to get in on this conversation that you've started at Define American, what do they do?
Oh, please, yes, please check out Define American. We have a stories platform that you can easily use. One of the best things that's happened in the past year is teachers, history teachers, high school English teachers have actually used it to build their curriculum around school. Mm-hmm. So that's been really great. And for me, as far as I'm concerned, it's not just people like me who have to come out. Our supporters have to come out. You know, like the people who support us on our daily lives. We can't afford you to be silent anymore.
What do you want to ultimately do with that information, Jose, in our last 30 seconds or so?
Well, look, we have a crisis of messaging when it comes to this issue. You know, and I really commend you guys for even referring to people as undocumented instead of illegal, right? The fact that we call people illegal speaks to just how dehumanizing the whole conversation has been. So to me, it's about having these uncomfortable conversations.
Well, we want to let you know that if you'd like to hear more from Jose, he's going to be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the National Constitution Center in the Kirby Auditorium. It's right across the street from us, actually. It's at 525 Arch Street, Independence Mall here in Philadelphia. So if you'd like to hear him again, that's the National Constitution Center, 6:30. Jose is going to be speaking there. And Jose Antonio Vargas, we want to thank you for taking the time to share your story with us, to have a bit of this uncomfortable conversation that you're really trying to, you know, have people enter into at Define American. We're so appreciative of your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great having you with us. And our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Dennis Devine, Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.